I think this is the battleground culture issue in America today.
How is it that we can trust an organization for whom abortion is such an important part of their business model to simultaneously effectively prevent pregnancy and prevent abortion?
The problem in America today is that people simply change the topic.
The key to successfully talking about abortion is to try to bring the conversation back to one key question.
When you're an obstetrician gynecologist and you're pro-choice, you have to decide whether you're actually going to do those abortions.
I believe that being pro-life is the most progressive value that we can have.
The abortion industry is most threatened by Christians engaging in pro-life work.
Finding that pregnancy center was the only person I had to support me at that time.
She's got to know when she takes that pregnancy test that her church is not going to treat her like the Pharisees tried to treat the woman caught in adultery.
As a church, we can't just vote pro-life. We have to be pro-love.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Such a great line, right? We just can't be pro-life. We have to be pro-love. I love that. That's a little bit of audio from a trailer for a new documentary called The Matter of Life. It's going to be held at movie theaters around the country. They have these events called Fathom Events, where they're only there for a few days. You might have seen the Divine Mercy film that I had talked about before, this Purgatory film that had aired. This one airs May 16th and 17th, so mark your calendar. Could not have come out, I think, at a better time. Get you plugged into more in the days ahead as we close in on those dates as well. And in a moment, we'll talk a little bit in greater detail about this. And you're more than welcome to, of course, join us anytime. But I'll give you a little background on this. And again, the phones are open for you. We're going to change gears in a little bit. But the big story of the day, and I think of the month, is going to be this battle for life in our country. Abortion's been at the forefront. Really, it's been, well, let me rephrase it. It's been at the front and back burners, if you will, of our country's cultural life for 50 years now. It's always been on. It's always been brewing. There's always been people defending life. There's always been this effort to try to protect the most vulnerable amongst us. Up till about a week ago, the life issue had been kind of back burner. I know a lot of pro-life groups that are out there, and I often look at these guys, and I'm thinking to myself, God bless them. You know, Eric Scheidler and so many different people with these groups have been fighting for years. You know, Brian Gibson at PLAM. I can name organizations all across the country. And I'm thinking their effort seems to fall on dead ears, you know. It's just people just have grown desensitized to it. It's the law of the land right now. What is going to ever change it, right? This has been a back burner issue, unfortunately, and it shouldn't be. It should be front burner and on high, right? When the war in Ukraine took place, you know, the whole world was focused on life and how innocent people are being killed by Vladimir Putin. But what happens in the midst of all this turmoil in the culture? We had the first draft, a leak of the first draft of the majority of opinion in the Dobbs case. And all of a sudden, this life issue is front burner, right? It burst out into the open in a way that I don't think anybody could have predicted. I thought, you know, the last day of the Supreme Court, before their recess for the summer, they're going to make this announcement. The media will go crazy. There'll be a couple protests, and that's it. Then it becomes a state issue, and that fight continues. But no, it has gone crazy. As you heard earlier in the show, there's been violence, right? There's been vandalism. There's been graffiti. Why do these groups, these leftist groups, these anti-life groups, always have to revert to violence and to vandalism and to destruction and to graffiti and to interruption of, you know, masses and do horrific things against people of faith? You know, I have no idea where this is going to lead, how far it's going to go, whether or not it'll get worse or not. We've had a discussion here at the network about that. I didn't think it was going to be as intense as what we might have seen before, but, you know, who knows? I bet there are efforts being put into motion right now for when the final draft of this ultimately comes out, and we'll see what happens. But the appearances of the anarchy symbol on the side of the building that we just spoke about, the Wisconsin Family Council leases, that's a signal that Antifa was behind that vandalism. So you got Antifa in the shadows here. It's not a very hopeful sign. So, You know, we can't lose hope. Just as all of this is coming out, there's a new documentary that's making the case against abortion. And I think we need to get out and see these things. I think we support these things. I think we need to educate ourselves, because this is going to be something that maybe family or friends or coworkers or neighbors might engage you in, and you want to be informed. The documentary is called The Matter of Life. It's going to be showing for 2 days, I said, May 16th and 17th, so you can look for it. Gosh, is that a week from today already? Where does the time go? I can't believe it. That's a week from today. I'm just looking at my calendar. I'm like, are you kidding me? I we'll find out where you can get connected to the film. But the film was produced and directed by a woman named Tracy Robinson. And she has been a video editor for the last decade, and she's always considered herself pro-choice, right? She was all about it. She understood the woman's rights and, you know, freedom and reproductive justice. And then she heard the argument against abortion as she was doing some work there at Ventura County Pregnancy Center in California. And that was when she became inspired to work on her own film to make the argument against abortion and for life. She was hoping to make the case to non-believing audiences. And I think that's a great way to approach it. You know, you don't want to preach to the choir, right? But she found that out of 4 out of 10 women, right? Check this stat out. 4 out of 10 women who had abortions, they were attending church the month they became pregnant. 4 out of 10. So that shifted her focus to try to reach a Christian audience. And if you want to join us, feel free to dial in. We're going to talk with her now. It's always good to have somebody on who's trying to take a new approach to defending life and speaking truth. And it's good to have her with us today. Tracy, thank you so much for your work. I'm delighted to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
As a former documentarian, I look forward to actually watching your documentary. I think they're a great way to break down issues and show both sides and to articulate truth. I know people can find out more at matteroflife.org if they want to check it out. But let's back up, though. How did you first come across the argument against abortion? And you know, you were champion for pro-choice for a while. I mean, why do you think you never heard it before? What was it? Tell us your story. Maybe that's a better place to start.
Yeah.
Bring us back. Turn the hands of time back. Bring us through your story.
Well, I wouldn't say I was a champion for pro-choice. I was very much apathetic about abortion, actually. But if you were to really boil it down and ask me to think about it, I would probably say, well, I'm personally pro-life, but who am I to take away that choice for other people? So essentially pro-choice. Okay. And I am in the shoes of a lot of I was in the shoes of a lot of people in that I just never thought about abortion very deeply. And so, like you were saying, I was doing video work for a pregnancy resource center in California and commissioned on and off to do some testimonial videos for them, and was very inspired by what they were doing for women. But I was still very apathetic about abortion and thought it was so nuanced and so complicated until they invited me to a conference where the topic was the case against abortion. And that's where everything changed for me.
And what happened?
So I heard within 2 hours the clear, concise arguments for the full humanity of the unborn child from the moment of conception. And the speaker, Alan Schliemann, he reasoned that it's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. We all know that. But he explained the truth from the science of embryology. It's clear in the textbooks that abortion is wrong. And therefore, abortion is the killing of an innocent human being, and therefore it's wrong. And at one point he invited us to look at imagery of the aftermath of abortions. And so the truth really just struck me. And I knew there were so many people in my shoes who had never heard this before. Maybe they went through public school their whole life, even grew up in church their whole life and never heard this topic addressed. And their family didn't broach it either. So I knew there were so many people in my shoes who just needed to learn the truth. Yeah. And have it unraveled for them. I knew nothing about Roe v. Wade. I knew nothing about the truth behind Planned Parenthood. I had to learn all that stuff for myself. And so I wanted to, what I was learning and uncovering, I wanted to give that experience to other people.
Yeah, you know, from a scientific perspective and just a moral position. I mean, it's fundamentally wrong, and you can come to those truths in a pretty direct way. But there seems to be, I don't know, real bias. I know you're doing this documentary. There have been a lot of great films that have been out over the years, a lot of great testimonies, a lot of great witnesses, a lot of great books. Yet, I don't know what it is. They seem to fall on dead ears. It's as though people are so, dug into their position that nothing is going to change them. Why do you think what you're doing is going to be successful? And what is it about that today? This is a horrible issue. I mean, clearly, and yet we have people so entrenched on either side of the line. And I really believe there's no gray. I think it's black and white. Either you're on the right side of life or you're not, right? Right. Mm-hmm. One of those two sides. So, but people are camped out, and they want to defend those positions. I see senators. I see presidents. I see people, so many people advocating for this culture of death. How do we pierce those hearts? How do we get their ears to open? How do we make them listen to something that they're already tuned out to?
Well, I think people need to think for themselves. And this documentary, it doesn't beat people over the head. It doesn't preach to the choir. A lot of people turn their ears off when you try to preach at them or tell them how it is. But what this documentary does and what I was so passionate about doing was unraveling it for people to really see, to invite them to look at it and to think about it. We address common concerns around abortion in very empathetic ways. We address her body, her choice. Like, that's a common concern and question that people have. Isn't it her body and shouldn't she have the choice? And then her rights, and what about her circumstances? And we even address the rape issue with a really amazingly powerful personal story of a woman who was in that situation and had to be faced with a pregnancy decision at a very young age. And so we not only convey the truth and unravel it for people, but we try to put the heart in. We wanted to put the heart into it as well. And we show a powerful personal story of a former abortionist. He's an OBGYN, Dr. Anthony Levitino.
He tells
his story of how of the moment he decided to stop doing abortions. Yeah. And so it really shows, it just reminds us that as much as we've been hard-hearted and hardened to this message, there is hope. There is hope for change. People can have a change of heart no matter who they are.
Hey, good always conquers evil. In the end, and I've said this for years, and I believe it, I hope I see it in my own time, abortion will be just a very dark chapter in U.S. history. It'll be a terrible mistake, and people look back as they do at slavery and think, how can the citizenry allow like something like that to happen? But it takes people like you. Just we had the Underground Railroads and we had abolitionists at work. It takes people like you, documentarians. It takes, brave politicians. It takes broadcasters. It takes writers. It takes witness to help bring about that conversion. I believe God's grace is at work, too. I think it pierces the hearts of a lot of people. And I really hope the documentary is going to do well. Let me grab a quick call. In Buffalo, New York, Samantha's listening. I think she had an opportunity to take a look at the film. It says she pre-screened the doc. Hey, Samantha, good afternoon.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. So, I wanted to tell everyone that you have to go and see this film. I did get an opportunity to watch a pre-screening. I'm the regional coordinator for a nonprofit in New York called Feminists Choosing Life of New York, and our director was able to... Yeah, exactly. So our director, Michelle, was able to get the pre-screen film. And we had an event for it at a local library a few weeks back. And let me tell you,
yes,
this room was packed of people. I had to sit on the outline of the room to see this film. And I was a member of the organization, from young and old. And it was so moving, and it filled with just information that I didn't even know, like mm-hmm. how legally, I believe, Roe v. Wade had defined the term health for the mother's health and the reasons why she should be able to get an abortion. And it was just so moving. There were some times where I cried. It was incredible.
Well, Samantha, thank you for calling.
Thank you so much.
Tracy, I'll let you respond.
Wow, thank you so much. Yes, I do remember that event. I'm so glad you had the opportunity to watch it. I really appreciate that feedback. That's what I wanted. I wanted people to, even people that are pro-life work, have the response that they've been re-inspired and they have this renewed vigor after seeing this film to keep going in what they're doing. So it's not just for people that are on the fence. It's for people that are convinced that abortion's wrong. But I encourage those people to see it too.
I think your mix of content is great. I mean, I know Dr. Anthony Levitino, he's been on the program. That's a riveting story. That'll certainly bring you to tears and move you. I've had women who are survivors of rape on the air, you know, who are born today because of that, and they and their mother. I mean, these are stories that need to be told. Earlier today, as I started the broadcast, we talked a little bit about the violence that's taking place at churches and abortion clinics and places around the, not abortion clinics, clinics and, you know, women's centers around the country. And, you know, several people had called in, and one person asked about rape and incest, you know, with the life of the mother. I think that's such a critical issue to put in, because I think 1% of all abortions take place, they're rape and they're incest. The 6% is that they deal with the life of either the mother or the child. So that means 92-93% are all, you know, it's fundamentally done because they don't want to have the child, or it's inconvenient, or whatever rational, irrational reason maybe they come up with. To that issue, you addressed rape and incest. That's a big one that a lot of people who are against abortion make the exception for. How did you cover that? I'm curious.
Yeah, I definitely didn't want to neglect that issue, that part of the issue and people's concerns in their minds. Like you said, I've met many people that are pro-life who have that rape exception, but the more I've been involved in this and the more I know the truth, that indicates to me that they don't get the whole truth. And so I not only wanted to tell people, look, this is when life, you know, we're talking about when life begins and what is the unborn child. But we bring in this powerful voice of this woman who, when she was in 9th grade, was attacked and raped by a boy she had been talking to. And she was faced with that decision, and her parents, her dad actually was very adamant that she get an abortion. And so at 15, she felt those motherly instincts to protect her child, thankfully. And she said, stop the car, when they were on their way to the abortion clinic.
Wow.
And so, and in her story, we also learn about what open adoption is. When I started researching for this film, when I started talking to more pro-life people, I didn't know what open adoption was. I knew what adoption was, but I didn't know about open adoption. So that's how in the dark I was on all these different options available for women. Thankfully, I've never been in the position in a pregnancy decision before, but I know that there's so many people that will be. Yep. Who don't know all these options. So the woman in this story, she went for an open adoption, and she got to pick the parents and got to visit her daughter throughout her life. And she wanted to do that to tell her daughter that I loved her, to tell her daughter that she loved her. So I just wanted to leave people to not neglect the really tough issues. This is a circumstance we don't wish on anyone.
Awesome.
But we want to also show people, like, there is hope in choosing life. And it's a very powerful choice. It's a very empowered choice to do that, because we're doing it for someone else. The abortion industry profits off of sex traffickers and rapists. They turn a blind eye to it. They don't report it. Over and over again, we see that. So it's abortion enables this kind of behavior. Wanted to address that.
I'm glad you did, because those are tough issues. My personal rationale, or not rationale, but philosophy, or a vision as to what's going to happen in the pro-life movement. Abortion is going to become illegal at the federal level eventually. States are going to, you know, make their own decisions. We're going to have this war going on at the state level. But the hard part of it, there'll always be these concessions where people say, okay, you can't have an abortion unless it's rape or incest. And that's a tough one to go ahead and to fight against. You know, there might be some states who really want to minimize it, but that always seems to somehow get put on the table. So I am just, can I tell you how glad I am, how grateful I am that you decided not to, you know, dance around that issue, because some people might say, ah. And just to speak the truth, we have to speak truth. We have to present it. And in the end, you know, that issue is going to be a key issue in the fight for life in this country and for women who've gone through that. And it's a real tragedy. You know, I'm curious about one other thing. I mean, you said something that struck me, that 40% of women who had abortions had attended church the very month that they got pregnant. So, you know, I'm curious as to what you found out when you looked into that. What's happening within the churches? What's happening when it comes to human sexuality or how people view it? Or are we failing somewhere along the way? Just give me your take on that. That's 2 out of 5 women are going to church and got pregnant that month.
Yeah, that was a profound epiphany that I had midway through making this project, was the rate at which women were having abortions in church. And it really struck me that also in my research, I found that well over 50% of major Protestant churches in America are silent or actually make exceptions for abortion. And that made sense to me. I mean, that correlated with the 4 in 10 women statistic, right? Because churches, church leaders, yep, you know, we as Christians have not been on the offense in people's minds and in their hearts and worldviews on this, yep, issue. Yep. And so we've deferred to the culture to educate young people and young women. We end up in a situation where there's rampant abortion even in church. And so, and then that snowballs into pastors not wanting to talk about it or confront it, because it can hurt so many feelings because so many people have had abortions in the church. That's the case with this film. Some of the biggest advocates have been women who've had abortions, or wow, and men also who've been involved in abortions. They're, yeah, some of the biggest advocates for this film because they know how much pain and how much hurt and destruction. Just educating people can prevent so much pain.
Let me ask you about that point, though, because I'm always, like, I know many women who've had abortions. You know, I worked with one woman who had 4 abortions, and then she ended up not being able to have a child. And to go to see Abby Johnson's film, it could be very visceral for her. And I often wonder how women who've made the mistake of this, you know, and who are now moving on with their life, who are trying to heal, how a movie like this, how a documentary like this will affect them. And I say that because, you know, I'm torn on the issue of showing images of aborted children. One side of me says it's an absolute must. Father Frank Pavone, a great priest who is a defender of life, I think he founded Priests for Life, he used to say abortion in this country will never come to an end until America sees it for what it is, because it's relatively sterile and invisible. You don't see the horrors of what are perpetrated. And yet there are others who would say, oh my gosh, you know, what about a woman who had made that mistake, or the man who was behind it, or what if kids are exposed to this type of thing? How do you balance that particular issue in terms of showing these images? And then secondarily, how will this film resonate with women who may suffer the pain of that loss?
Right. So we do have a segment where we do show abortion imagery, but we give them a prompt that allows them to close their eyes if they want to for 50 seconds. So they don't have to look if they don't want, sure, to, or if they don't feel like they're ready. Most people that have had abortions, they already know the reality. They've felt it. They don't need to look any further. But it was really important. Scott Klusendorf, who is a speaker in the film, he's always set up the purpose of looking at abortion imagery. He's always set it up in context when he gives talks. And he uses the story of Emmett Till, who was a young African-American boy in the Deep South in Mississippi in the 1950s, who was brutally murdered, and his body was found in a river after he had offended some white men. And his mother was adamant about having an open casket funeral because she wanted to show the whole world what they had done to her boy. And that was very controversial, that decision to do that at the time. And but it actually inspired Rosa Parks to sit at the front of the bus. That imagery, and so it's credited for the images of his open casket and how brutally beat up he was. Mm-hmm. That is credited for sparking the civil rights movement in our country.
Amazing.
So Scott sets it up very, just giving us the context of why we need to look, to at least look and see what the truth is, what abortion really does, and take it out of that kind of abstract conversation and into reality. I think that's really important.
Well, I look forward to seeing it. I got to leave it right here. I know it's next week, so people can find the Fathom event. The movie's called The Matter of Life. I'm speaking today with the director, Tracy Robinson. Tracy, if people want to view the film, what's the best way to connect? How do they track it down?
Yes, they can go to matteroflife.org, not .com, but .org.
Oh, sorry.
They can go to matteroflife.org and get their tickets, find the theater in their area. It's playing in well over 600 theaters across the United States, so awesome. Hopefully they can get to it.
TheMatterOfLife.org. Check it out. Congratulations. Keep up your good work. We need you. I know this film's going to touch a lot of lives, so look forward to
hitting
the theaters. All right, we'll try to stay on it. That's Tracy Robinson. TheMatterOfLife.org. If it sounds interesting to you, check it out. See if it's in a theater near you. It's going to show on May 16th. And 17th. When I return, we'll change gears. I want to talk about Vladimir Putin's Victory Day speech and what message he communicated to the world. Stay with me. You know, we receive over a million prayer requests every year, thanks in part to the Catholic Order of Foresters Studio Line, helping us stay connected to your intentions. Learn how our sponsor can support your family with life insurance at relevantradio.com/Forester. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
It's hard to overstate the almost sacred importance of Victory Day here and how much it's bound up with the notion of sacrifice, the millions of lives lost in World War II. So whatever victory it is that Vladimir Putin declares on Monday, that idea of sacrifice, the cost to the Russian people, will also be there. Unfortunate, but necessary for whatever greater goal it is that he declares.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was Sky News. There was a lot of speculation as to what Vladimir Putin would say on Russia's Victory Day that commemorates their victory over Nazi Germany in 1945. Today, of course, marks the 77th anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe, and Russia marked this as Victory Day. It's most important secular holiday for all of that time, but it always entails a massive military parade on Red Square in Moscow. I don't know if you saw any of the imagery of this. I got a chance to peek at it earlier today. They display thousands of troops or latest of their military hardware. And this year, you know, it was a little bit different. Experts were expecting, maybe wondering is a better word, if Vladimir Putin, if Russian President Vladimir Putin would make some kind of threat about the use of, you know, that weaponry, the nuclear weapons, maybe even call for the mobilization of massive amounts of troops to be sent to the Donbass region of Ukraine to support the Russian troops who are already there trying to basically annex that region for Russia, or maybe both. I mean, who knew? I was curious. I thought about it. I wonder what he's going to say. What message is he going to send to NATO? What message is he going to say to the rest of the world? And we know additional sanctions have been levied on him, right? The screws are really beginning to get tight. None of that happened. Vladimir Putin didn't do that. Instead, in his speech, he didn't really say a whole lot of anything new. So there's no one key line that I thought, wow, that's telling. So this comes just a few days after Russia conducted a series of tests on one of their missiles, which are actually carrying of capable, they say, of carrying nuclear weapons. So in a Russian enclave, a little area stuck between Poland and Lithuania, they did this test. And according to the Sun, the Russians also said that they conducted multiple strikes on mock missile systems and airfields and protected infrastructure and military equipment and command posts. And just a couple of days before those tests, Putin had said that, you know, if somebody intends to interfere in what's going on from the outside, they must know that constitutes an unacceptable strategic threat to Russia. They must know that our response to counterstrikes will be lightning fast. And again, I'll pause on that particular quote because, you know, he does have this hypersonic weaponry. I mean, that thing, those missiles can zip 10 times the speed of sound. Some of them, it's pretty amazing. They're fast. He went on to say, we have all the weapons we need for this. No one else can brag about these weapons, and we won't brag about them. We will use them. So, of course, you know, who wants to hear those type of threats, right? Not me. I'm sure not you. Interestingly, Belarus, which is allied with Russia, they also mobilized their defense systems. They started large-scale drills to test their troops' combat readiness. But none of this, again, put off the president of the Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky. He came out with his own Victory Day speech. He was dressed in camo. He filmed himself in a deserted street. And it was apparent that he was resolved to defend that country's, to defend his country and say, hey, we're unbroken. In fact, I saw some men who were trapped. I think they were Mariupol. And they said, we know we're dead men. That's why we fight so ferociously. I mean, these guys are willing to lay their lives down for what they believe. And it's pretty amazing what's unfolding. I thought today would be a good day to look at, you know, how does Vladimir Putin get out of this? Will we see peace? Is there an off-ramp? I tend to believe that Pope Francis's consecration of the world has set things in motion. Something in the invisible, something that we cannot see, is at play. How that works, I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know how far off it is. Is it months? Is it years? Is it days? I don't know. I'd love to go to Dakota Wood. He's retired as a lieutenant colonel from the United States Marine Corps and right now senior research fellow for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation. And his insight, his worldview, his expertise, his knowledge is just always a great conversation with him. And I've invited him back on this momentous day. If you want to check out a work that he's involved in, it's called the Index of Military Strength. And you can find that at the Heritage Foundation as well. It's well worth checking out where we as a nation stand. Lieutenant Colonel, always a delight. Good afternoon.
What a delight to be with you. Thank you so much, and looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, so, you know, over the weekend, as I knew this day was looming, I thought, oh, I hope you're available. I want to get your take on on what Putin's going to say. And I was waiting to see what nuances I can pull from it. But what's your victory day? What's your take on that speech? Maybe I'm missing something. Would you characterize it as a nothing burger or as a lot of analysts did? Or is there something to it that maybe I'm missing and they're missing?
No, I don't think you're missing anything. It wasn't a nothing burger. I mean, it's a significant event in Soviet and then, of course, Russian history. All of these speeches are written at multiple layers. You know, there's a domestic audience. There's a political power structure audience. There's an international audience. And so the speech writers have that in mind. And then the person delivering the speech always has, like, underlines or margin notes, or they'll kind of riff on a theme or something like that. I mean, it happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Certainly when John F. Kennedy gave his, speech in Berlin, and Ronald Reagan gave a speech, right? Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. I mean, all these kind of very seminal sorts of speeches have these different audiences in mind. And what you saw from is what, something like 12, 13 minutes long, if that long or so, from Putin. You know, he did reference, Nazism. He did reference wish that other countries had been able to participate in this great, day of victory, the Brits and the Americans and the French and others, and they were, forbidden or, not permitted to participate because of the ongoing conflict. And what he has said in the past, recent past, about this issue of Nazism and going into Ukraine, to defeat this this old enemy of the Soviet Union and then Russia, You know, these are themes that he carried forward into that speech. So I think he was trying to strike a balance between the patriotic remembrances of what the Soviets did back in 1942, 43 through 45. You know, they suffered something like 8.7 or so million military casualties total, including civilians, for something like 27 million people from all causes in that war. And so it's a huge emotional event. And so he did have these little references tying it to this, you know, special military operation in Ukraine. But, you know, to your point, he didn't make it about Ukraine. So I think he was striking a balance for the domestic audience to increase their patriotic support of him, his connection to the people and to this great war. And in the background, you have him trying to do the same thing and protecting Russia from the threat of NATO and Ukraine.
Yeah, it's to that point, though, about where the world is and how they view him. I read something earlier today, and I forget where it was. I should have actually sent it to myself or printed it out. They made the case that, okay, we've got NATO and its allies. A lot of the West are against them. They're putting sanctions. But there's a lot. They say the other half of the world, you know, half of the world's population is in support of him. You've got, you know, of course, China and a lot of these other dictatorships. But you've got Brazil. You've got other nations that are saying, hey, his message is, I had to do this because the West was being aggressive. And a lot of people bought that. I mean, how true is that? Where's the rest of the world on this? Because I understand that he's actually doing okay with some of the oil exports and things he's getting. The higher prices are working to his advantage. Where's the world? We have our own narrative here in the West and with our allies. Right. And then, of course, he has his that he's, you know, sending to his own nation and to others. Break that down for me, if you could. I mean, how does the world view this, and you know, where does he stand right now?
You have other countries, big and small, that just don't want to see one country dominate world affairs. So even though we view the United States as a force for good, for all the reasons that we could talk about for hours, you know, if you're India and you got 1.4 billion people, or you're Brazil, the largest economy in South America, or you're China with 1.3, 1.4 billion or so, wouldn't it be nice to see the United States taken down a notch, you know, to see them kind of put in their place or, you know, moderated in some way? So, I mean, you make this awesome point that the rest of the world doesn't necessarily see the world through the United States' eyes, right? And that there are other national interests. You know, India and China have both agreed to Russian demands to buy energy in rubles. Even many countries in Europe, up to the point where they've said, hey, they're going to wean themselves off of Russian energy entirely, is still sending euros to a bank that then converts it into rubles, and then the rubles are sent to Gazprom, you know, the big Russian energy giant and all. So, you know, there are these forces in play that are not completely aligned with the United States. And I think we really formulate and implement not so effective policy when we don't account for these other perspectives, right? I mean, if you want to be effective, you have to account for the audience, you know, the people whom you're trying to curry favor with or lead or whatever that might be. And we often forget that because we've got things so good here in the United States and such a great place to live and our value system. And we just naturally want to kind of imprint that on others. Everybody, you know, thinks about individual liberty and freedom, you know, freedom of religion, all these sorts of things that really apprise here. And it's just, the fact is, the rest of the world doesn't operate that way. You know, they just don't. And so you have something like $1 billion a day from Europe going to Russia in the purchase of energy. And if the, you know, the war has been going on for 74 days or something like that, the Europeans have given Russia, you know, $74-75 billion. Don't you think that fills up the coffers?
Wow.
You know, and I drive a diesel, and so it's $5.50 a gallon for diesel at the pump. You know, that money's going someplace.
Wow.
And you know, so it's just, we have to account for that in our policy. The stability in our country, the political alignment, instead of all this divisiveness, and certainly a strong U.S. military, which we've underfunded for about 30 years now.
Yeah, you're not kidding. My guest today, Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, we're taking a look at Putin's Victory Day speech and really where we are right now. Dakota, I have to take a short pause. When we come back, I'd love to get your analysis on what the exit strategy is. How does Putin save face? How does he end the suffering that he and his people are going to be enduring? A lot of sanctions are underway. He underestimated, I think, the world's response and certainly the economic reaction to this. But I'd love to get your insight on how the cards are soon going to play. You can join us, too, if you want to get in on the conversation. I only have one segment left, but we'd love to hear from you. 888-914-9149. You can call now.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Turn it up!
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
You don't even know. Well, thanks for joining me today. It's good to be with you today. We are looking at Vladimir Putin's Victory Day speech. Was there anything said in it that will give us some insight into what the future might look like for this battle, this war in Ukraine, and ultimately for the rest of the world? Of course, I pray for peace every day. I invite you to do the same thing. I think prayer changes things. I think it's an important aspect of what's going on. But I think we also have got to take a look at what's happening. A lot of people funding the effort in different ways. I was actually reading an article over the weekend about how millions of Russians, they're actually tearing holes in their own digital iron curtain, if you will. And they've downloaded all these virtual private networks, are called VPNs. And it's a tool that lets them, you know, kind of surf the net and actually hear the truth, because Vladimir Putin, of course, has shut down, you know, all the media there. You know, if any journalist was to report other than what the state once you reporting, you could see 10 or 15 years in jail. And right now, what I'm hearing is that there's been a ton of these downloaded. And it brings back memories to the 1980s when the Soviet Union was you know, in power. And people would use shortwave radio to hear what was a forbidden news broadcast, forbidden news from you know, U.S.-funded Radio Liberty at the time. So a little bit different. Instead of the airwaves, they're using the internet. I'm joined today by somebody who is very familiar with the USSR, very familiar with our military in particular, and that's Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Woody Ailes from the Heritage Foundation. And you ought to check out the Index for U.S. Military Strength. He's the author of that annual report. A lot of work goes into it, and it's very telling. Before we talk Vladimir Putin, let's talk about that for a moment. I'm just curious about our own military strength, because on another side note, Colonel, yeah. I had heard with all these Stingers and Javelins and all these weapons that we've been exporting out there that our stockpile is now being diminished. I don't know how mm-hmm. true that is. Where are we in terms of our own military readiness? China, they showed they've kind of flexed their muscles the last week with a flyover right. in Taiwan as well. So if we had to go on two fronts, I'm always concerned about that to defend. But where are we in terms of our own military readiness?
Well, we've been we're at kind of a marginal level on a scale of A to F. We're at kind of a middling C, and actually getting worse, tending toward a D grade.
Wow.
For the last 20 years of military ops, we fought insurgents and terrorists with no Air Force, no Navy, no Army, you know, none of the conventional things. So you were able to do whatever you wanted to do without opposition in the big strategic sense. So we haven't bought a lot of military gear to replace old stuff because we weren't losing a lot. So we haven't bought a Stinger, a man portable shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missile. We haven't bought a Stinger in 18 years.
Wow.
So if you're in the Stinger-making business and you've got no sales,
wow.
you know, do you maintain a workforce and a production right. line, you know, for a product that nobody buys, right? So what we've been doing to provide to Ukraine is taking from existing inventory fully one-third of the Javelin anti-tank missiles and one-quarter of Stinger anti-aircraft missiles have already been sent to Ukraine. And the manufacturers for those things say, we have to recruit workforce, we have to ramp up production, and it will be 3 to 5 years before we can replenish the munitions that we have been providing Ukraine, right? I mean, it's going to take that long. So it's just one of those realities where if you don't have a demand signal, you know, requirement to buy things, then the producer of those things isn't making them. You know, why would they do that? There's no business model for it. So we have very old equipment. Our frontline fighters are average over something like 31 years old for the average frontline fighter. Our average pilot in the Air Force is only flying about 1.5 times a week, less than 10 hours a month, if you can imagine that. Over half of our Navy ships are greater than 20 years old. In the Cold War, we had almost 600, about 580. Today, we have 298. And over the next 5 years, that will reduce to 280. So when you think about Russia and China and North Korea, we have essentially half the force of what we did when we were dealing with the Soviet Union, you know, 30 some odd years ago. And it's almost the same equipment. I mean, we just have old equipment. So if you're in the military, you are doing the Lord's work. I mean, noble, noble service to the country, and people joining to serve the country are just amazing individuals, but we haven't really been supporting them with the best training opportunities and the newest equipment.
Colonel, we only have a few moments left. I'm curious about the exit in this situation. You know, Vladimir Putin, again, going back to the Victory Day speech, didn't level any allegations or threats. There was no real saber rattling there. Usual pomp and circumstance, if you will. But I'm assuming he probably wants out of this. I think he seriously underestimated the reaction of the world. I don't think he saw what was going to come financially for his country. And I know that they just levied more sanctions against him. How does this man, how does he save face with his people on the international community? I don't know if you can do that after what he did in Ukraine. Their reputation has been sullied. But what's his exit? How does he do that? And are we helping him to do that? Or I understand we're really not.
Yeah. Well, it could actually harden his position. Again, it's what does Vladimir Putin think? What is his paradigm, not the United States? So if his view was that this Ukrainian territory actually belongs to Russia, and it was given away unfairly, that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a catastrophe and all that, and he is trying to reclaim cities like Odessa and Kyiv and Mariupol, et cetera, all the agricultural terrain, all the industrial capabilities, all the Black Sea coast port cities, you know, if he views that as a rightful thing, then the very fact that the West is supporting Ukraine actually amplifies his sense that Russia is surrounded, the rest of the world is against it, and it's all very unfair. And so he's actually doubling down on his effort. So what he might be able to do is declare victory if he says that they've defeated Nazism in Ukraine, if he's prevented NATO from establishing bases, if he has kept Ukraine from joining NATO and the EU, and he has gathered in industrial and agricultural areas in these coastal cities along the Black Sea, you could say that that's a huge win for Russia and the Russian people. And he actually has a lot of popular support inside of Russia. So what that tells us is we can't stop supporting Ukraine, because a Russian victory in this sense solidifies his hold on Eastern Europe and will actually embolden him to start then making claims on countries like Moldova, possibly go back into Georgia to, you know, continue his encirclement to the Black Sea, and even threaten the Baltic states up north.
Yeah, one of my takeaways from this, and I might just be naive, I'm on the sidelines, you know this better than me. You know, there's been saber rattling with the threat of using nuclear weapons or hypersonic type of technology against forces or supply lines, or yet we have not seen that. Do you think that we are at a point in the world where no one will ever go to that extreme? I really hope that's the case, but with all this rattling and threats, and we don't see that happening. He says they all use it as an existential threat, you know, to the nation, but I pray to God that's the case. How do you read it?
I think there is a very real risk. You know, half of North Korea's population is on a starvation diet, and yet Kim Jong-un finds enough money to develop an expanded inventory of nuclear weapons. China has tripled its inventory of long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. Russia has a large inventory of what are called tactical nukes, you know, things with more of a limited yield you could use in a smaller area than a mega bomb, you know, that destroys an entire city. So these other countries are investing, you know, hard-earned capital in those things for a reason. And again, if you look at the world through Putin's eyes, and he views the rest of the world as trying to impose and encircle and limit and minimize Russia, you know, what might he do to push that back and to show Russian greatness? So I think we cannot dismiss the potential that as things get desperate, that he tries to expand the war horizontally, you know, more places, longer ranges, other instruments, and go vertical in terms of the intensity of the war. So if he used some kind of a tactical weapon in Ukraine, a non-NATO country, would the United States respond with a nuclear weapon, right? I mean, this is the big question. How do you actually respond to that? So I think the risk is not zero. I'm not saying it's 80%, but I think we cannot ignore the possibility.
Well, again, I'll go back to what I said earlier. Let's pray for peace. Nations without God, people without God, and without respect for the dignity of the human person, I think are more likely to press that button and use those weapons than somebody else that perhaps has that spiritual view. Hey, Lieutenant Colonel, thank you for your time. Always a delight to have you here. I wish we had more time, but please check out Dakota Wood there at Heritage Foundation. He's the author of their annual report. If this is interesting to you, check out the Index for U.S. Military Strength. And our gratitude to the Lieutenant Colonel for 20 years in the Marine Corps. I'm out of time for the day. Thank you for allowing me to share part of it with you. I'll be back in about 21 hours. Until then, God bless.